Hello, and welcome to Korean Context. My name is Nicholas Hamasevich, Director of Research and Academic Affairs at KEI, and I will be your host today. President Obama wasn't the only leader who had to make important visits to multiple Asian countries this past April. Australia's Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, had to make an important trip of his own to Japan, South Korea, and China. Haley Channer, an analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, who is also a visiting scholar at the East-West Center in Washington, D.C., believes that there are some interesting comparisons and themes that can be drawn from these trips. In addition, she thinks there is room for Australia to help mend Korea-Japan ties. In this episode, we discuss these ideas, as well as Australia's views of Korea and Asia. Haley, you wrote a great piece for the East-West Center last month, comparing Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott's early April trip to Northeast Asia with President Obama's late April trip to Asia. What was the main thing that jumped out at you that helped you draw these comparisons?
Sure. Well, actually, there are a few things that I thought I could compare their two trips together. One of them was how closely their schedules aligned. Also, the fact that they had a few of the same countries on their itinerary. And also the fact that they both had similar goals to achieve while they were there. For instance, Tony Abbott, he wanted to achieve a lot in the trade area and also security, and that was the same with President Obama. So I think, you know, I wrote my piece before Obama actually made his trip, and it's easier now to draw, you know, parallels and comparisons between the two now that they're both over. I think, you know, on the face of it, Australia is seen to have gained more through that visit. But what we have to understand is that I think the trip was a lot tougher for Obama, and what he was trying to achieve was a lot tougher. You know, Tony Abbott signed a free trade agreement with South Korea. He agreed to a free trade agreement with Japan and also gave a commitment in Beijing to finish a free trade agreement as soon as possible. But, you know, what we need to remember is that the free trade agreement with South Korea was negotiated over 5 years. The one with Japan was after 7 years of negotiation. And then with Beijing, you know, we're looking at almost a decade of negotiations. So I think, you know, having achievements in those areas really betrayed the fact of how long the negotiations have been. You know, and then on the security front as well, Australia was seen to be gaining quite a lot. You know, it had a new agreement with Japan, the framework agreement, just to share military science, technology and equipment. With South Korea, there was another agreement to share military information and some more defense exchanges with China. Again, with Obama, you know, a lot of the headlines were about security, but I think from the public view, it looked like Obama gave away quite a lot and didn't gain anything in return, for instance, on TPP. But I think, you know, a lot of that criticism is really unwarranted.
When you were talking about Prime Minister Abbott's trip, and you're talking about Japan and South Korea having a willingness to engage Australia, but then also kind of, it seemed in your analysis that they were also trying to weave their way into another aspect of U.S. security and U.S. presence in Asia through Australia. And so and another author kind of noticed this with Korea's relationship with India. Well, the U.S. was reaching out to India, so Korea would also reach out to India, and you can kind of be part of a larger U.S. presence and U.S. effort to Asia by reaching out to these other countries that the U.S. is involved with. Do you think that was an aspect of Korea and Japan when they're trying to talk with Australia, the U.S. factor in that?
You know, I think that might be partly true, but I'd also like to think that Japan and South Korea want to engage with Australia in its own right. You know, I think that Australia's importance to both of those countries is really increasing as we see strategic dynamics in Asia Pacific really start to become a little more challenging. I mean, for Japan, Australia has been, you know, a really good partner. It's a staunch ally of the United States, and we have a lot of the same values as Japan. And for Korea also, I think Australia is becoming a more important partner for South Korea. You know, we're both like-minded. We have a lot of the same liberal democratic values. And I think too, you know, a lot of our relations are deepening, you know, in the trade area. We just signed that free trade agreement. But I mean, Australia is South Korea's seventh largest trading partner. And for Australia, South Korea is our fourth largest trading partner. So in addition to that, you know, we have more South Korean students visiting Australia. There were over, I think, 17,000 South Korean students now studying in Australia. And, you know, I'd like to see more Australian students going to South Korea as well. But I think for both Japan and South Korea, Australia is really increasing in importance in the region. And if you also look from the US perspective, Australia's importance is increasing. You know, we have a very important geostrategic location. Our size is important. And also the political voice that Australia can offer is increasing in importance to the United States. But, you know, as you're suggesting, I think all three countries do want to see the US remain committed to the region. But that's for slightly different reasons. You know, for Japan, it wants to see the US committed because of its challenge with China over territorial disputes. For South Korea, I think that's more for the reason of North Korea and managing North Korea's aggressive tactics. And for Australia, you know, it really wants to see the status quo maintained in the Asia Pacific. And also it wants to see the US engaged because of the liberal democratic values that the US brings. So I think for similar yet slightly different reasons, they do want to see the US engaged. So, you know, perhaps Australia does look more attractive to Japan and South Korea because it is a staunch ally of the US, but I'd like to think it also brings a few things that make it attractive in other areas.
Sure, sure. One of the things you talk about with democratic values is we had, at various times, we had trilaterals and quadrilaterals, you know, with Australia and Japan. So you have like the US, Japan, Australia, India quadrilateral, which is a nice grouping there. Where is the progress on that? Is it still ongoing? How do you see that quadrilateral?
Actually, you know, discussion on this topic has been quite quiet in Australia ever since around 2007 when Kevin Rudd withdrew Australia from those discussions. A colleague of mine last year, Andrew Davies, he gave a bit of an update on the progress of that on our institute's blog, The Strategist. And, you know, he sort of said that there's a few reasons why Australia might be a bit hesitant to get involved in this kind of quadrilateral. And one of the reasons he mentioned was that all of the other players in this quadrilateral have more difficult security circumstances than Australia. So, for instance, you know, India has some border issues with China. Japan has some territorial disputes with China. And obviously, the United States has a lot of other security concerns. And so he brought up the fact that one of the reasons Australia may not want to get involved is because it could be having too many security trade-offs by getting involved in this agreement. So I think that's one of the reasons in Australian thinking why we're a bit hesitant. Also, you know, thinking about bringing South Korea into something like this because it is another liberal democratic state. My colleague Andrew Davies did bring this up as well, but I think really the enthusiasm behind this movement has sort of subsided, and the fact that Shinzo Abe hasn't brought this up really in his next term as Prime Minister, I think is telling that there's a lack of momentum for this idea. And personally, you know, I don't know that this would be a great mechanism to rehash given the tense security environment that we have now in the Asia Pacific. I think China really would see movement in this area as encirclement. So, you know, perhaps there are other areas where we can do some multilateral engagement that wouldn't antagonize China quite so much. And yeah, that's about the state of the quadrilateral dialogue in Australia.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is there's been such a movement toward the East Asia Summit, ASEAN Regional Forum. And so these type of forums and summit meetings, any chance that you can have a side meeting of these four countries at an East Asia Summit or an ASEAN Regional Forum, or is that still just being too cute about it and trying to hide it as much as possible?
You know, I don't know. I think if it was to happen, it would have to be driven by Japan again because Abe had the original idea. And I think really, you know, he's concentrating more on other security issues. I mean, I think he has enough now to deal with just with reinterpreting the Japanese constitution and getting some more domestic support for some changes that he would like to see. So really, I mean, if that were to happen, that would be good, but I don't know if more progress towards towards that area would be better for the security dynamic at the moment.
You mentioned in your piece, you talked about how Australia spoke out about China's ADIZ announcement and how a lot of, especially in the US, we appreciated the Obama administration, people in the US appreciated Australia speaking out about it, even though Australia wasn't a main factor in that realignment and that drawing.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people look, say, well, Korea, this is what you should do when you, even if you're not involved in it, Korea and other countries, this is what you need to do. You need to speak out when something is wrong, like the drawing of the ADIZ, or if you feel it is wrong, like the drawing of ADIZ. How do you think Australia thinkers should feel about that being used as a model, or you using the ADIZ announcement as a model for speaking out about other issues, especially that the US doesn't think is right?
You know, Australia is in a much easier position than a lot of countries find themselves in the Asia Pacific. You know, it's hard to compare South Korea and Australia and what South Korea should do in light of that, because Australia is really in a privileged position. It doesn't have really any external threats. It's not in Northeast Asia. It's not in between China and Japan. And so really Australia has the luxury of being able to say things that, you know, other countries might find a little bit difficult to say. So, you know, I think from an Australian perspective, we wouldn't expect South Korea to speak out so much because South Korea is in a very different situation. I saw Carl Friedhoff from the Asan Institute speak here at KEI a few weeks ago, and I think he really hit the nail on the head when he said that after the US rebalance, there's no other country in a more difficult position than South Korea. You know, South Korea is divided and it has a hostile country to its north. And I think, you know, Park Geun-hye has been very much trying to push for unification. And I see a lot more discussion about unification under her presidency. So I think, you know, that weighs on the minds of a lot of South Koreans and their approach to China, because China is seen as the country that can resolve the issue of North Korea and also manage the threat posed by North Korea. They find it a lot harder to speak out more strongly against Chinese actions, even if that's not, you know, what they would like to see China doing.
Right.
Even South Korea's territorial dispute with China, you know, they're very cautious. And I think the South Korean media is much more measured in its response to China. So, you know, I understand that the difficulties that South Korea is in, which Australia is not in. Would I like to see South Korea going on record, you know, to protest action that it sees China doing as being sort of outside international law? Yes, I would like to see South Korea doing that. But will it help South Korea in the short term? No, I think actually that would probably be harmful for South Korea. But I think if you get a lot of other countries in the region sort of speaking with the same voice and saying, you know, this kind of action, you know, it's not appreciated, it's not, you know, following international norms. I think if you have more countries speaking out together, that would be a good long-term strategy for South Korea.
I think it's interesting because you have things like this China-Vietnam situation, right? You have China moving an oil rig closer, and so you're looking for countries to kind of speak up about that. And so that's an example. That's, again, a tough situation like you talked about, but that would be an example of a situation that doesn't directly involve Australia or doesn't directly involve Korea, but you're, as the United States, you're looking for other people to kind of speak up and push China and say, look, this is really not helping the situation. You're not helping the status quo. You're not helping peace in the region. This is not what we want to see as countries in Asia. This is not what we want to see. So that is an example, you know, taking Australia saying,
yeah,
your ADIZ is not an example of what we want to see. And then, okay, now we have this situation in Vietnam,
yeah,
those types of examples.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, I would like to see South Korea, you know, as I said before, speaking out against things that it doesn't agree with. I think that's important, and having, you know, more countries in the region sort of explain what they feel is reasonable behavior and how they would like to see disputes settled. It's tough, though. It's tougher for South Korea because, unlike other countries in the region, South Korea is divided. And, you know, one of its main goals is unification. And it sees China as critical to that. And it wants to be sympathetic to that because, you know, I think it's quite a pivotal moment at the moment with where North Korea is headed with its nuclear and missile programs. And I think that all of those things play into South Korea's calculus about how it's going to respond to China. And also there is a little bit of concern about how much the US is engaged in the region. So while I would like to see South Korea, you know, having that voice and you know, sort of saying a few things, I realize there are constraints on South Korea from doing that. So, you know, it's a very hard thing to balance.
One of the things I like examining is the dynamic in the region. We have all these countries that China is their number one economic partner. The U.S. is their number one security partner. So how do they balance that? How do they deal with that? And for Australia, one of the interesting things that I think is going on is the conversation about that, where you have experts in Australia talking about this dynamic and how Australia should handle it. In many ways, it seems like Hugh White kind of helped start that process by writing that the U.S. should basically share power with China in Asia, and that in many ways, Australia should tilt toward China. And so you had, through his writing and then others kind of writing and responding, you've had this conversation. What are some lessons from that conversation that has happened in Australia that you think South Korea could use or learn from or just look to with that conversation that's happening in Australia?
Nicholas, this is a great question. I really, really appreciate this question.
Well, it's a great conversation. You can, you know, see it going back and forth and all the people writing about it.
We're very lucky in Australia to have Hugh White and to have him start this debate for us, you know, and in a typically Australian way, he gets right to the point of an issue and brings it out so that we can all talk about it. And I think the debate is really, really good. Perhaps, you know, I'd caution, you know, that there is a bit of a problem with how well known Hugh White's argument is, because I think, you know, there are a lot of people in Australia who don't agree with Hugh White and are actually on the other side of the spectrum. So I think it's remarkable for the fact that it is, you know, a lot of people here in Washington have brought up Hugh White's concept with me. So it is well known, but actually it's not representative of the majority view in Australia about what Australia should be doing re the US alliance and China's rise. So, you know, we also had a former Australian Prime Minister, Malcolm Fraser, come out with a new book called Dangerous Allies. And that's sort of reinforcing this idea, well, the majority of Australians must think that the US alliance is bad and that we should actually be tilting more towards China. So I think maybe the first lesson for South Korea is that there's two sides of a debate and that it would be good to have as loud voices on the other side, you know, representing the other side as well. Wow. But, you know, thinking about other lessons for South Korea from this debate in Australia, I think one that would be very important to take away is that debate is not as open in South Korea. It's more difficult to have this kind of debate. And, you know, I think South Korea would really benefit from more open and free debate on really difficult, controversial topics. You know, but again, you have to realize South Korea is in a different geostrategic position from Australia. And actually, I'm not so certain that South Korea would benefit from debate on this particular topic, because I think there are those in the US who already see South Korea tilting towards China. And if you were going to have a rigorous debate like this in South Korea, it would be received much more differently from how it is in Australia. So maybe, you know, my point is that the debate is really good, but maybe not on this particular topic. Another lesson I guess you could take is that it is really good to sort of think through some of the contingencies that could happen in the Asia Pacific. I mean, this debate that Hugh White has started has really forced people to start thinking about these issues and thinking them through. And if you don't start to at least have some contingency plans, then you're not prepared for what the future has. So maybe that's another lesson to take from it.
Another interesting topic has been Korea-Japan relations. And so for the United States, how do you handle Korea-Japan relations? How do you try and get them better? You wrote a great piece for your home institution, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, where you suggested Australia could help out and help mend some ties between Japan and South Korea. What are the biggest reasons why you think Australia should get involved in these difficult dynamics?
You know, a lot of my friends in Korea and Japan asked me the same thing when I was interviewing them, you know, why is Australia interested in getting involved in the the dynamics that we have, you know, between Korea and Japan, because it's so difficult, you know, what's Australia's interest? And I think that the point was really missed by some of them, how much of an impact security and bilateral relations in Northeast Asia impacts Australia. I think they didn't understand really how much Australia is impacted because, you know, three of our top four trading partners are in Northeast Asia. We have major strategic concerns there. And also, you know, two of our closest partners in Asia, Japan and Korea, are in the region. And I also think that Australia is more tied to the region because of its alliance with the United States and its alliances with Japan and Korea. So I think, you know, Australia is very much linked to the region in a lot of ways that aren't fully appreciated by everyone in Japan and South Korea. And although we have a lot of interest in the region, we actually don't have a lot of influence there over issues. So I actually think that through, you know, a trilateral arrangement between Australia, Japan and Korea, Australia could really enhance its influence in the region and kind of guide certain aspects towards its own interests. So, you know, I think some of the things that Australia could gain from this kind of trilateral partnership would be progress on areas of mutual concern to all three. And by that, what I'm talking about is nuclear non-proliferation, ballistic missile defense, cybersecurity, counterterrorism, things like transnational crime, and then also, you know, peacekeeping and HADR activities. I think there's a lot more to be gained in those areas. And also, you know, when you start to do trilateral activities between the three, you increase interoperability. And also, I mean, looking in a more broad strategic way, having more diversified security ties is a good hedging strategy against the shifting regional dynamics. So we don't really know what's going to happen in the future. And I think cooperation more with like-minded states is actually a really good thing to sort of hedge against those uncertainties. So I think, you know, for all of those reasons, there's something to be said for a trilateral arrangement. And better relations between Japan and Korea also mean that they can cooperate more on issues that impact Australia directly. And by that, I'm thinking of North Korea. You know, they could really increase their cooperation on that. And North Korea has a major impact on Australia because if anything were to happen, you know, Australia is a signatory to the UN and the ceasefire agreement there. So Australia would be immediately involved in any kind of contingency. I think those are important things to think about.
Right. So when we talked about the importance of trade in the region and so that how that ties into security, but how much with North Korea testing its missile satellite, how much and going from kind of north to south and doing the polar orbit, so going toward Australia rather than their usual route over Japan, mm-hmm. does that play into Australian defense thinkers' mindset or process when they're looking toward Northeast Asia and saying, okay, North Korea was successful going north to south, possible doing a north to south test launch again. And so now we in Australia need to think about those dynamics.
You know, I think any improvements in North Korea's missile and nuclear programs does encourage Australia to cooperate more with Japan and South Korea because, you know, we don't want to see North Korea increasing its capabilities in those areas. I saw recently that the US, Japan, and South Korea have ease the preconditions for going back to the six-party talks to denuclearize North Korea. And I think that's a really good step because, you know, from my personal perspective, I think that the strategy of non-engagement with North Korea is actually not the best strategy. And I think that even though it's said to be rewarding North Korea's bad behavior by giving in and going to talks, I think that actually engaging North Korea through talks can have the advantage of delaying any progress in those programs because I don't think North Korea is going to stop either of those programs, no matter what. I think the regime sees it as key to its survival. But I do think that engaging North Korea can delay its progress in those areas. So I would like to see a bit more coordination between Australia, Japan, Korea, you know, and the US, but also a sort of change in policy to allow the six-party talks. And I think that we could also develop just a better response, a more unified response to North Korea.
Did the North Korean arrest of the Australian citizen, John Short, did that help kind of bring that conversation more into Australia about North Korea and how to deal. I know he kind of lives in Hong Kong, but being an Australian citizen and getting arrested like that and having a series of different arrests from different citizens, like Kenneth Bay from the United mm-hmm. States, for example, did that bring about more conversation about North Korea and how Australia should be thinking about North Korea and encouraging Japan, South Korea, and the United States to deal more with North Korea?
You know, Nicholas, that whole issue about John Short was kind of totally washed in Australia because we had some other major events happen either side of him being detained in North Korea.
Oh, really?
So, I mean, exactly the same time that he was detained, we had Russian forces flooding into Crimea, for instance.
And yeah, that took over all the headlines.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
And then afterwards, we had the Malaysian flight go missing. And then over the top of this all, we also had an Australian who was convicted on drug charges in Indonesia, Chappelle Corby. She was released from the Indonesian jail where she's been there for years now. So really the issue of John Short didn't really feature in Australian news. It was kind of like a flash in the pan and then it was over. So I can't really say that that had an impact. But even if it was a slower news day in Australia, I don't think it would have had a lot of impact because of the circumstances surrounding his his detainment. He was putting out Bible tracts and he knew the risks involved and what would happen if he was caught. So I don't know that there was a lot of sympathy for him because he was well aware of the risks. So
going back to kind of the trilateral dynamics, you talked about how sometimes it's difficult for the United States even just to do military trilateralism with Japan and South Korea, and that in some ways that even though it brings the three countries together and helps bring South Korea and Japan together, it's not really mending the ties and mm-hmm. mending the animosities that's coming between the two countries, right? But for you, you're talking about, well, Australia should kind of help out in that aspect. So what were you kind of seeing the difference between U.S., Japan, South Korea military coordination mm-hmm. versus Australia, Japan, South Korea military or security coordination?
Yes, that's right. You know, in my paper, I'm really advocating for Australia, Japan, South Korea trilateral security cooperation. And while I really think that US trilateral initiatives are invaluable and they really definitely have a place, I don't think it's without problem. You know, the US is the security guarantor of both Japan and South Korea. And like Professor Robert Kelly of Pusan National University says, you know, he says it creates a moral hazard between Japan and South Korea. So they really have no reason to cooperate because the US is always going to be there guaranteeing their security. So they can continue both playing into the rivalry between the two countries without any kind of fear of a long-term consequence. So I think, you know, that's one problem with it. Also, you know, there's a problem with the fact that if the US is the one leading these trilateral initiatives, these talks and any exercises, people both in Japan and South Korea can say that the cooperation is being forced. You know, it's not mutually desired by either country. And I think, you know, that's a problem because it opens up both administrations to criticism from the media. And, you know, the other thing is that trilateral cooperation with the United States alarms China. And it also alarms North Korea because North Korea is wondering, you know, how is this going to affect us? So, you know, I think that I don't want to do away with any of the US trilateralism. I think it's really important, but I think it could be supplemented with trilateralism with Australia. And the reason I think Australia has a role to play is because, you know, it avoids a lot of the problems associated with the US. So it's not guaranteeing Japan or South Korea's security. It places all three of them on a much more level playing field, right? Australia is not in direct competition with China and it's seen as much more benign in the eyes of North Korea. I think you avoid that problem. And, you know, I think you also avoid the domestic criticism, or some of it at least, in Japan and South Korea, because if there was bilateral cooperation between the two, there'd be a lot of criticism. When you add in Australia, it doesn't seem like the same kind of cooperation. And, you know, I think Australia is seen as a little bit more benign. So they can actually cooperate more easily with Australia. So, you know, I think having those cooperation between like-minded countries really could enable Australia to be a bit more of a bridge between Japan and South Korea and allow them to cooperate when bilateral cooperation isn't possible, for instance, now.
And tying back to our initial part of our conversation, talking about President Obama's trip to Asia, and part of the difficulty was he had basically had to reassure Asia that the U.S. is going to be in Asia, the rebalance is there, it's real. The U.S. is going to be involved in Asia. So for Australian experts like yourself, how do you see the U.S. rebalance and kind of the evolution of the concept of rebalance under the Obama administration?
You know, it's difficult to say because right now the issue is being clouded by a lot of external events, you know, like the crisis in Crimea and the issue over Iran's nuclear weapons and what's going on in Syria. I think it's very hard to say how it will progress. I think the policies of engagement with the region will continue. I've been talking to a lot of people here in Washington and hearing a lot of different views. One view is that after the next presidential election, we won't be hearing the tag rebalance anymore. It will be something else. It will be rebranded under a different administration, but the policies will remain in place. I think, you know, the US can't not afford to engage with Asia and invest more in Asia because of the current trends. So I think the rebalance will continue. And I think the US is trying to put forward two different messages. One message is that it's not leaving the region, it's going to stay engaged. But the other message is that it wants US allies in the region to also take more responsibility for their own region, do more in a lot of different areas, the same areas that the US is investing in the rebalance. So military area, diplomatic, political, and even really the humanitarian and cultural area.
Well, Haley, thanks so much. This was a great conversation, and your papers have definitely helped us look more at Australia and what Australia is doing in Northeast Asia. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Nicholas.
Our guest today was Haley Channer, analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute and a visiting scholar at the East-West Center in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for listening to KEI's Korean Context podcast, and we hope you will listen again next time.